in the natural environment, how to get haywire in the urban environment, what the consequences of that are, and then how we can turn it around, if not entirely, at least significantly. So the title there has been given to you, and I don't have a screen up here, so I have to stand out here so I can see it, but that's all right. I don't like to hang behind the podium anyways. So to talk about urban hydrology, we have to start with the system as it existed before us. And this is describing the Pacific Northwest, but it applies to one degree or another just about anywhere. We have, of course, in our natural landscape, it's forested. One, and the trees provide hydrologic services, regulating the water cycle. They intercept precipitation on its way down. It sits on the leaves. It can evaporate over time, and we believe that that is not an insignificant event, even during the winter. Those trees create an organic layer on the forest floor, we call it duff sometimes, that has storage capacity. And then, of course, the vegetation, especially the large vegetation, takes up water from the soil into its tissues, and over time will transpire some of it back to the atmosphere. The soils are the partner of the vegetation in this. They store a lot of water themselves, and when we have a natural soil, even if it's on top of glacial till, we have the ability to store about a month or maybe even 2 months of winter rainfall in that soil. And so as a result of that, surface runoff is rare. Most of it infiltrates and some of it evapotranspires back to the atmosphere. And as much as it rains around here, it's really surprising to a lot of people, and was to me when I first learned it, that surface runoff doesn't tend to occur in most storms in the natural condition. It's held up in the soil and in the vegetation and comes off the surface runoff in the really big storms or late in the winter when the soil is saturated. Now, when we get to urbanization, everything's turned around. The trees, of course, are removed along with their hydrologic services. The soils are, to one extent or another, and often to a large extent, removed during the process of construction. They may be returned as topsoil, or they might be hauled away and put somewhere else. But in addition, the heavy vehicles compact the soil so that we lose that storage capacity in the soil, either by just losing the bulk of the soil or losing its ability to admit water, and generally both. And as a result, most land cover is either impervious or impervious-like. And we know that our, you know, beloved suburban lawn is, from direct measurements, acts almost like an impervious surface. It comes very close in terms of the runoff coefficient that is associated with that kind of a surface. So the hydrologic output naturally then switches around from primarily infiltration, evapotranspiration, to surface runoff. And in addition to a conversion of the hydrologic cycle, the water is picked up and conveyed away as rapidly as possible. I mean, that has been the paradigm of water management in urban areas for now over a century and a half. Pipes and ditches take it away so that instead of staying where it was in order to nurture the system and supply the vegetation and supply streams and wetlands in the dry season, it's taken and exported out of the basin or sub-basin. And in addition, while I'm talking primarily about hydrology, human activities, of course, generate hundreds of water pollutants in the bargain here, and make some reference to water quality as well as hydrology. Just to get some comparison of change in landscape and what it means to the change in hydrology, let's take that old growth or even mature second growth forested condition on the left. Let's go to a typical suburban there of about 20% impervious on to 60%. That would be typical of North Seattle. The Thornton Creek watershed lingers around 60%, a little more, a little less, depending on where you are, and then to a central city area of almost entirely impervious. We go from the surface runoff as a percentage of total output from less than 5%, as I said, surface runoff is relatively rare in that condition, up to about 20% in the suburban condition, up to a majority in the residential city condition, like much of Seattle, up to at least 85%. We get a little bit of depression storage and some evaporation in the almost totally impervious situation. In terms of stream flow, the two-year peak stream flow, which let's take as one, a unit of one, for the forested condition, approximately doubles to suburban, approximately quadruples to the urban residential. And why don't I have anything there in the lower right? There are no streams. They've all been piped underground. And as a matter of fact, when we get much above 60% in the urban areas, at least in this part of the world, that's the situation. The streams are underground. Of course, this all has impacts on streams and the life in streams. We have a stonefly at the left, spawning salmon on the right. We know that's an urban stream there somehow. And the high velocities that are developed by these high peak flows sweep away the small life forms like the invertebrates. They stress the bed in the bank, causing erosion and the loss of the riparian vegetation. That undercut bank is about to fall in. It will lose that vegetation. That stream will widen. It will incise. That's generally an insidious process of downcutting, widening, downcutting, widening, you know, in different degrees and patterns. But that's what happens in urban streams. And, of course, the sediments that come off of that eroded bank and the eroded bed do a lot of things damaging to life in the streams. They reduce light. So photosynthesis is not as good. The fish can't see as well. Feed to avoid predators. The sediments are irritating to their tissues, especially the gill. They carry other pollutants like metals and organic chemicals. These are often toxic. They clog the fish spawning gravels where the eggs are laid. And the consequence of that is that oxygen doesn't get to the eggs that are as much as a foot below the surface of the stream, and the eggs expire of asphyxiation, usually. What is very prominent, and I'll show you some data here in a bit, in urban streams, is that they really have almost no pools, because these sediments, when they're carried along to a slow area, the deep pool, they deposit, and they gradually fill the pools up. So then also from the land runoff, of course, these pollutants that are generated are in higher concentrations, that's mass per unit volume of water, and higher loadings, that's mass of pollutant over time, because we've got more volume going off the urban landscape, and that volume is more contaminated, and so naturally you've got more total mass loading to the system, and you know, in large amounts. Now, in order to put some quantitation to this descriptive pattern that I have just given you, we did a study over a period of about, altogether, around 9 years, from start to finish, in which we investigated streams throughout the Central and South Puget Sound, and there were more than 70 streams and almost 170 reaches on those streams that we studied. And I'm going to show you some of the key results that kind of put some numbers to that, to the consequences of hydrologic change. First, we used the so-called benthic index of biotic integrity. It wraps up 6 or 8 attributes of the invertebrates, that's the benthic community, into an index, a number. And we plotted that versus total impervious area in the watershed. It's a crude measure of watershed condition, but it turns out it's quite a useful one. And if there's time and interest, I threw in a few slides at the end that show a little bit more sophisticated way of doing that, but not something that that does a particularly better job of signifying that pattern. So what we see is that we can have the highest scores in the invertebrate community only if we have less than 5% impervious. That doesn't, however, guarantee that we're going to have it. Notice that there is still some range there, but it makes it possible. It's a necessary, although not sufficient, condition to get the best community. And then we drop off, and over at the right side, We have a community that is less than half of the best number. The best number is 45 in the system. Less than half of the best number is inevitable if we have more than 45% impervious. We do have a little bit of a camel's hump there, you see, in the middle. This turned out to be some sites on two streams in Snohomish County that had more preservation of forest and wetland in their watershed than others in their cohort, which kind of, you know, turned the light bulb on in our mind about some other important things to maintain to keep a good biological system. Now, I have put that previous graph there for reference in the upper right, but this time I'm plotting that benthic index against something else, and that is, you can't quite see it down there, but it's the ratio of the two-year peak flow rate to the winter base flow rate. In other words, it's a representation of that multiplication of peak flow that I told you goes on in suburbs, double, urban areas, quadruple, and so on. And what we see is a similar pattern. It tails off as the stream gets more dynamic. We say urban streams are flashy. That means they go up and down fast. And we see that the highest scores are only possible if we have that ratio or the two-year frequency rise of less than 10 times. So if that peak is no more than 10 times the base, then we can keep that community. But when it gets up to as high as 70, then you know that community is stressed in various ways to such a degree that it's going to be only the most tolerant of organisms. Now, does this fit together, you know, hydrology with the urban condition? Well, yes, it does, because there we see that this two-year peak flow to winter base flow ratio is related to total impervious area in such a way that we can't achieve that no more than 10 times rise, generally only if the impervious is less than about 7%. 7% is the number over there at the far right that you can't see. And so again, what I'm representing by that vertical axis is that the distance between that green baseline and the peak of that. And that is a very typical hydrograph for an urban stream, as compared to that's Mercer Creek in Bellevue, as compared to the, in blue, Nuwaka Creek out around Enumclaw, which is an agricultural watershed. Now, in addition to the invertebrates, of course, what we're even more interested in are the fish, and the salmon in particular. And we used the ratio of coho salmon to cutthroat trout. Cutthroat trout are more resilient to flow conditions in a stream. And they will tend to become dominant, as we see, as urbanization increases. Again, on the bottom axis, it's total impervious area. So we get the highest condition. We have a gap there because of lack of data. We have the highest condition in terms of the success of coho salmon, only with very little urbanization, very little impervious. And it doesn't take too long till we get out to, you know, we get to that suburban stream, and we've got a cutthroat dominance. You know, it seems to be, you know, the way that we've managed them anyways, that has been inevitable. Now, what's the reason for this? You know, why do fish and invertebrates have such a difficult time in urban streams? I'll give you three reasons. There's many reasons. I'll just give you three for kind of a, you know, big picture. If we look at the pie chart of pools, riffles, and glides, riffles are where they, you know, the fast-flowing areas, good oxygen exchange, where they tend to spawn. The pools are the slow areas where they can rest and feed. And the glides are, and I'll show you a picture of one in a moment, their habitat that's not of particular value to either life stage. So what we go from with the non-urban condition is almost all riffles and pools. Down to the highly urban condition, we lose some riffles, but we particularly lose pools. And we're up to almost 45%, or almost 50%, 40-some percent, of the habitat is glide, which looks like this. You know, that's also a straightened stream. It would not tend to be that straight in the natural condition. So that's one reason. We lose the habitat. Another reason is water quality. You know, let's bring in this little discussion of water quality. Here we've got total zinc concentration flowing in a series of streams during storm condition. This is, in fact, the same storm. We got a cluster of points relative low concentration with low impervious area. It jumps up when we get to the suburban condition, and it jumps up higher and begins to challenge the state water quality standards, which are held to be the toxic thresholds for zinc. Of course, there's many more chemicals in there besides zinc, but that's a story that I have to wait for another day. I don't have time to get into that. So water quality is another reason for stress. This is, zinc is toxic to aquatic life. Even if you take it as a supplement, you're a mammal. Zinc, and for fish, that's not so. We believe that what's happening there in the highly urban areas is you get, you know, much more vehicle traffic, and you get the industrial-like land uses coming in, like auto shops and that sort of thing, even if it's not heavy industry. Now, notice one other thing that's interesting is that we don't get concentrations that are reputed to be toxic at moderate levels of urbanization. However, by that time, if we remember back to the biological graphs, there's been a lot of loss in both the invertebrate and the fish communities. That loss is happening primarily because of hydrologic stress. And so I've often said that if we're sending water down the streams at the rate we are, and it was distilled water, we'd still have degraded streams. Because hydrology hits first, and it hits really hard, before the water quality comes in and begins to add greatly to the stress. Another reason, the third reason I'll give you, I'll go back to the story about spawning. Chris May over there, who sees his life flashing before him, did this work, and I'm surprised he's here. He's not hearing anything new. Chris went out and put aquarium stones at the point where fish deposit their eggs in streams. And I know this is difficult because I helped it once or twice. And imagine how difficult it is for the fish to get their eggs down under the gravel. And drew samples out and tested them for dissolved oxygen and compared that dissolved oxygen, which is intragravel, IGDO, to the oxygen up in the free water column, and found that, again, with urbanization, you get a loss of that exchange, of that transfer of oxygen from the atmosphere through the water down to where the eggs are. And where it's up at 80% and more with low urbanization, and as we'll see, that 80% is about a threshold for good success for the anadromous fish. It drops off, and it's very variable out there, but it's down as low as 30% at high levels of urbanization. And does this matter to the fish? Yeah, here's the cutthroat again, or the coho to cutthroat abundance ratio. And you see that to get a coho dominant community, you have to have 80% at least of transfer of oxygen from the surface down to where the eggs are. Okay, so those are three of numerous reasons. Now, told you the problems. What can we do about it? This kind of takes up with the latter portion of that 20 years of research that I told you about. Well, what we have learned is that if we look back to that first slide that I showed you of natural hydrology and take a lesson from it, that we can recover, at least to a degree, from the effects of urban runoff on the surface. And that is by naturalizing urban drainage systems, by utilizing or mimicking the natural hydrologic functions, using vegetation and soil to reduce the quantity of stormwater runoff produced and to improve the quality of anything remaining. So if there's, you know, one sentence that encapsulates the way that the field of stormwater management has moved in recent years, that's it. We look of the natural hydrology. We try to reproduce it. We can't, of course, bring back the old growth forest in Seattle. But we try to reproduce its functions, and we do that for two purposes. Reduce the quantity, and that will take care of these hydrologic stress effects, and improve the quality of anything that remains. And that will take care of the water quality part, to the extent we can, of course, accomplish that. So I'll give you a report now on Seattle's natural drainage system projects, which we partnered with the city here at the university. The city's designed them, built them, and asked us to monitor them. They thought they would do good, and asked us to find out if, in fact, they were doing good. So we started that in 1999, and we started with two projects. One of them, shown here in the summer of 99, is a street in northwest Seattle, 2nd Avenue Northwest, which was converted over the next year and a half to something that eventually looked like that in the lower left, called Street Edge Alternatives. It is the hallmarks of it, the most important features of it, are impervious reduction, taking that wide street, making it somewhat narrower, but also taking the gravel, which was sitting right away at the sides, and which is virtually impervious itself, and reducing that, and converting that area to compost-amended soils with several vegetation canopy layers. Canopy is the word over there that I would really wish were showing, because that's an important feature of these. Remember, in the old growth forest, we have vegetation intercepts precipitation. That's what we're trying to do here. We have vegetation that is bulky enough to take up and hold some water. Again, we're trying to do that. We can't get the old growth, but we can get a good dense stand of vegetation at higher layers, middle layers, and lower layers out there. And that's what we're trying to do. And it looks, doesn't it look a lot nicer? The other project, at the same time, same day in the summer of 99, was a grass ditch. It was on about a 4 to 5% slope, also in northwest Seattle. It flowed down the hill, went over an embankment. There was a catch basin there, but it frequently bypassed and jumped over, went down the hill into Carkey Park and eroded the steep slope there. That was converted to, because it was a more sloping street than the first one, into what's called, the city calls a cascade. And that is a series of log weir cells, you know, stepping down the hill. It doesn't look anything like that today. It hasn't for years because the vegetation has grown up and you don't see that structure. And that ugly stuff there in the foreground is our measuring equipment, our weir for flow control and our standpipe for instrumentation. So that's, if not gone, if they haven't taken it out, at least it's grown over and nobody has to look at it anymore. So those are two models. Flatter street, more sloped street. Well, how did they work? The first one, the C Street, was an eye-opener to the extent that it's become virtually world-famous in the stormwater management field. You know, you don't see it on a lot of popular literature, but in our field, it's really big time. Well, the old street, we had the opportunity, a very good opportunity that we often don't get, to monitor it before it was changed, baseline monitoring. It discharged all 35 of the events that were monitored. And these happened to be also in the spring and early summer, so it wasn't the wettest time of the year. Certainly very different than a non-urban situation that rarely discharges. In the first 2 years, it discharged in less than 7% of the events and discharged less than 2% of the volume of surface runoff per unit of rainfall. That is, we took all the rainfall and all the volume that we measured and divided them to get a simple performance measure. It took it down 98%. That was surprising enough and caused people to say, your data must be wrong. Go back and check. But even more surprising, since around this time, 7 years ago, it hasn't discharged at all. Now, at least up till when we quit monitoring in June of 2007. And we quit then because The previous November was the wettest month in Seattle history. And October of 2003 was the largest 24-hour storm in Seattle history. And so we thought, well, we'd seen it all. We're not going to accomplish anything by staying out there doing more monitoring after that. I was there the day of that storm. Everything around it was roaring, and it was just kind of sitting there passively, quietly, soaking up water, doing what it was supposed to do. What we think happened at that point is that the vegetation had become mature. It was 2 years after it was put into service. And then we got interception, you know, by the larger vegetation. We got tissue storage. And another thing, a little bit more subtle perhaps, is that as the root structure develops, it creates channels through the soil so that the water will run down along the outside of them. It helps to pull, take it down into the deeper soil, improving the chances of infiltration down, you know, to the permanent water table. That's what we believe is happening, not from any particular measurements. Now, we monitored that first cascade, but I'm not going to talk about it because we monitored a second cascade project to a greater extent. We got more data out of it, and so I'll talk about that one. This one is also in northwest Seattle, and it's on a sloping street of about 6%, and it was built in a cascade configuration a little bit differently with the weirs that you see there instead of the log weirs. It again had a composted soil that is 30% organic, 70% mineral soil, and river rock as well in the base. And in the central Puget Sound and northern Puget Sound, we have a lot of glacial till. It's our most dominant soil type, and that is a hard layer. Tends to occur 2 to 4 feet below the surface, sometimes less, sometimes more. If it's disturbed, it's usually less, and that's one of the reasons we get so much surface runoff. So in order to improve the soil storage capacity, that's why we add in the organics, compost it, to build up that soil storage in a situation over till, or even, you can even, if till is so close to the surface that it gets involved in the excavation, you can even improve a till soil by amending it. In this case, we did both water quality and hydrology monitoring, and I'll show you some results from both. This is a plot of the inflow to the system in red and the rainfall in green over about a 2.5 year period, and that's the cumulative volume of flow that came out, you know, either went in or came out. Now, that is very typical of an urban situation, is the rainfall and the runoff track each other almost identically because, you know, it's mostly impervious. There's not much to keep it from running off very quickly. So those curves almost lie on top of one another. At the outflow, the black curve, we see that cumulatively over the period, it was about half as much, and in particular, 48% exactly. Now, that is good, but we observed that as this cascade flowed along several blocks of street, that there were side streets came in and flowed from 110th itself into it. And we didn't believe that this was a true picture, that there was actually more coming into it than we could measure at the inlet. So we did a very careful estimate of what that flow in was on the sides. And we believe that, taking that into account, it was about 75% of all the water came in did not go out. That's our best estimate. That's not as good as the C Street, of course. But this is a sloping street, and the flow is bound to be more rapid. And it's also farther down in the watershed. And so it takes a lot of flow. And it's 75% that it eats up compared to the 100% that the sea stream is eating up is actually more important to the stream. It represents more water. And so these things work in tandem very well. One for a flat stream, do everything you can up there, and then get the remnants, get anything that still you can't collect up above in one of these cascades. Another look at the hydrology. We plotted the rainfall depth versus the rainfall in the seven preceding days. In other words, representing the wet versus dry condition. And we found that this reached kind of an asymptote. And under any circumstances, we can fully retain 3/10 of an inch of rain in that. In dry conditions, you can retain up to an inch, which you see over there on the left. And the red curve is the maximum, and in some cases, even with a lot of rainfall in the preceding 7 days, you can do better than 3/10 of an inch. You can do almost twice as well. Also, it discharged in only 49 of the 235 storms in the record. So again, it isn't the complete vanquishing of surface runoff like the sea streets, but it's very, very good in terms of restoring a semblance of natural hydrology. I'll show you a few water quality results. This is total suspended solids. The sediments are a general pollutant. In urban runoff, they carry other pollutants. And here, the inlet and outlet concentrations are plotted against one another. And if they were equal, they would lie on that diagonal line. But you see that they lie on a line that's almost horizontal. In other words, as the inflow gets a little bit more dirty, the outflow doesn't get very much dirtier at all. It stays down at some fairly predictable level. And I'll show you a little bit more about that. Let's take one of the toxic metals, copper. It's really an insidious one in the urban environment. It comes from a number of sources, prominently brake pads. If we're really going to get rid of the copper problem in our streams and estuaries and all our water bodies, we're going to have to address that source. Again, similar behavior to the total suspended solids. You get a little bit dirtier influent coming in. The effluent doesn't get much dirtier and considerably better quality than the influent. Now, it falls apart a bit when you get to soluble reactive phosphorus. And I just wanted to show you that not everything is, a happy face picture. But this is really the only kind of drawback in its performance. Soluble phosphorus is very, very difficult to hold because these are vegetative systems. They take up phosphorus, but when they die this time of year, they release it again. And most of the storms are now. So it's the worst time to retain phosphorus. And so we see this anytime we use some natural system to try to address pollutants. We do a pretty good job with everything except the soluble nutrients. Nitrogen is another one. Nitrogen is highly soluble as well. The soluble metals we do a fairly good job with, not as good as the particulate metals, but the soluble nutrients, just because they're such a they cycle in the natural environment, are the difficult thing to address in urban runoff. Now, just to give you a kind of a busy slide here of the results on effluent quality, I like to measure the quality of how well something's performing in three ways. What's the reliable maximum concentration? What could we really rely on? If we need it to be below those toxic water quality standards for zinc or copper, can we get it? That's one thing, reliable maximum. Irreducible minimum concentration. That means, what can't you go below? If you say, I've got to have 10, but it can only give you 15, then don't fool yourself. You know, you're not going to get 10 out of that device, you know, that way of doing things. And the other way that I like to express it is in terms of the cumulative or long-term pollutant mass loading reductions. That is, over a year's time or 2 years' time, how much of the mass do we hold back and prevent from going out? And for a reliable maximum concentration, just as one example, we got 40 for total suspended solids. So no matter how dirty it was coming in, this could get it down to no higher than 40. Often less, but no higher than 40. But it could not get it down below 9, you know, which is still quite good. And then in terms of the mass loading reductions, at least in the second column there, those are conservative numbers because they don't take into account those side flows. The middle column takes into account our estimate on the side flows. And so you see that the numbers jump up as a result. And you see that, by and large, we're getting 80 to 90 plus percent loading reduction of these contaminants, with one exception, the soluble phosphorus, which goes from negative to not very impressive. However, and can't see that right side there, but if we use conventional stormwater management, you know, ponds, grass swales, sand filters, we get lower numbers, 50 to about 80% for solids, as opposed to as much as 93. And the metals are lower yet. You can see they start at 30% and go up to perhaps 60 at best. So I think we found a better way to manage stormwater, by not only for hydrology, but also for water quality. So just to sum up, and then we'll see what you want to do with the rest of your class here. Surface runoff is relatively rare in the natural Northwest landscape. Infiltration supplies water bodies for the dry period. Runoff, in contrast, dominates the urban hydrology, and it flows quickly off into the water bodies, where it causes a lot of trouble. Both the flow and the pollutants have many negative effects, some of which I've shown you. But by naturalizing drainage systems to exploit soil and vegetation, we can get a lot of that back that we had in the natural condition. And there's a whole range of techniques that have been invented today that can be applied in new development, in a landscape that, you know, is just breaking new ground. In redevelopment, you know, when a city area changes from one form to another form, say from residential to commercial, or lower density residential to higher density residential or whatever. And then also to retrofitting. And that's what the city has done in its drainage systems. It's gone into watersheds that were been there for 40 to 50 years. They're not being rebuilt, but they went in and rebuilt the street drainage system. That's called retrofitting. So I will stop, I think, right on time. And what would you like to ask questions? So I'll give you a chance. Yes?
Yes, it is.
Yes. Yeah, it's similar. And nitrogen is in the forms of nitrate and ammonia, in part, which are dissolved. I mean, they're entirely dissolved. And then it's in some particular forms as well. So it's similar to phosphorus. Phosphorus ranges, you know, 30 to 70% dissolved in early runoff, depending on what, it's kind of hard to tell, but, you know, in different samples. Nitrogen is probably even more soluble in total than phosphorus. Yes?
How much did those Cascade projects cost?
Oh, I thought maybe you'd ask that. Okay. The cost for that, after, you know, piloting and, you know, getting into the next stage, a little, you know, more to pilot it. But when it got down to more of a routine thing, about $325,000, as compared to building a street, normal street curb and gutter drainage system with concrete and steel pipe would be about $100,000 more. And the Cascade costs just a little bit more than half of the traditional for a street drainage system like that. And then the city did a 15-block area in a combination of C Streets and a Cascade, and that cost about $280,000 per block. Yes? Smiling because I never give this talk. I haven't given a talk like this for years, but somebody hasn't asked that question. It's not a matter of if, it's when. The question is, do the pollutants build up in the soils? Does it become a problem, the accumulation? The oils are degradable, and they're not very high generally in urban runoff, unless there's some kind of an accident or spill. And so they're not a problem. Other organics are degradable too, to a certain extent. Of course, the old-style pesticides were only very slowly degradable. The newer pesticides, while they're damaging to the environment, are more rapidly degradable. It's the metals that are of most concern because they're elemental. They don't break down beyond their chemical elemental form. Soils, most soils, and especially organic soils, as these are, have huge capacity for metals. In terms of them using up all the binding sites and breaking through and getting loose in the environment, that's decades. It's probably like a century in soils like this. The other thing is it a toxic hazard to humans who might contact them? There really haven't been studies, real good, thorough ones on that question, but there have been some studies on catch basin sediments. And they point out that in industrial areas, it's a problem to the extent that sometimes they fail hazardous waste tests. In residential areas, they don't. They really never do. Is it a good idea, nevertheless, to let children play in them? Probably not. But they're built in such a way as to sort of be discouraging to entry, at least by children. But it's not a large or rapid accumulation. Yes.
When you were mentioning the statistics and the data that was gathered for C Street and the volume of water that was being caught, is that for all of C Streets or only the original C Street?
That's the original one. That's the one we monitored for about 6.5 years after it was built.
Have the newer ones been monitored?
That's the only one we directly monitored. Yes. Yes.
We heard last time from Cliff Matt, Professor Cliff Matt, that it's hard to find an indication of increased precipitation in the Puget Sound lowlands from climate change. Have you had any thoughts about how that, if climate change is going to be a big driving force in the lowlands here, like in areas like Seattle, for hydrology?
Well, I think that I'm personally at the very beginnings of thinking about climate change. I'm doing something now that I'm going to have to begin to think about it as an element, as a factor. But I believe that the effects of impervious area, and taking that term in the broadest sense of not just concrete, but also lawns and gravel and other impervious-like areas, are so much stronger of a driving force that we really need to work on reducing their presence and bringing under control the ones that remain, primarily while keeping a watch on climate change. It's not clear about in the lowlands here in the urban areas what we're going to get. Are we going to get more evaporation that might undo the effects of more precipitation? Precipitation patterns going to change. We just, that's all crystal ball at this point. But impervious area is here and now.
Given the attractiveness of the C-Street experiment and the cost differences, are we seeing these alternatives being widely implemented? Is the city building more of these?
Well, the city, I believe, has some problems at the moment. And I think Chris and I were talking about this the other day, that primarily they're being built now to address combined sewer overflows. You know, they're the real acute pollution problems that for general stormwater, I guess there's none right now in going in?
No.
Mm-hmm. The economy. Well, as a matter of fact, the Department of Ecology has been ordered to bring it into its requirements, and that is being worked through right now. Sidewalks, of course, are a good thing for safety. They can be built on just one side of the street. They can be built narrow. They can be built for porous pavements. This street got sidewalks as a benefit that it didn't have before. And so sidewalks they can be built to, in a way that's, attractive like this and not significant hydrologically by building no more than you need and especially, these were not, but build them out of porous pavements.
We have time for maybe one more question before we wrap up.